I next met with Dr. Leisha Sequist, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
This is a lovely 69-year-old never smoker who is a college professor and started having some headache and neurologic symptoms, came into the emergency room, and unfortunately was found to have a solitary brain mass. Staging was done in the hospital, and it looked like it might be from a lung cancer source because she had a lung mass, but with the swelling and the symptoms from the solitary brain mass, she went to surgery, so the diagnosis was made on the surgical resection of the brain. And she ended up having lung cancer with an EGFR mutation, L858R.
And what was the tissue type?
It was adenocarcinoma.
And was she a smoker?
No, she was a never smoker.
And when did you first encounter her?
So I met her after that, after the surgery had been done, and she knew about the diagnosis. She was in the process of getting some radiation to the area of the surgery, and we were going to talk about systemic treatment.
What was her state of mind at that point? And incidentally, we tend to explore more about the personal aspects of this on the nursing program. What was her state of mind at that point, and what was her sort of circle of loved ones? Did she have a spouse?
Yes. Well, obviously, she was shocked to find out that she had cancer, as most people are when we meet them. I think she was having a particularly hard time because it had been less than a year that her husband had passed away from cancer. I believe he had esophageal cancer. So she was really still mourning that and trying to regain her footing. So this was really quite a shock. But she did have a supportive community of friends around her.
And when you saw her and evaluated her, what were some of the thoughts that you had? Did she have the disease anywhere else besides the brain and the lung?
No. So we were mostly thinking about what kind of systemic therapy. Her symptoms had been neurologic, and they were relieved after the treatment. She wasn't really having respiratory symptoms. So the main thing was treatment.
Did you explain to her, and how do you explain in general to patients sort of what tumor mutations are, what an EGFR mutation is?
Well, I explained to people that some, but not all, cancers, and lung cancer in particular, have a driver mutation, and I describe it like a light that's been stuck in the on position, a signaling light. And our healthy cells go about their business, and they use these lights to signal. Sometimes the lights are on, sometimes they're off. And what can happen in cancer is that one of the lights can get stuck in the on position and just be telling the cell to grow all the time. So the idea with genetic testing is to see which light might be driving the growth, because lung cancers could have one light or another, and the treatment is specific for the light switch. So you have to match the light that's stuck in the on position with the treatment.
And I guess a lot of people, when they hear the idea of a genetic change, think about a hereditary change. But this is not a hereditary abnormality. It's just...
Yeah, and that's really important, because if people, their first thought is for their children or their grandchildren when you say you want to do genetic testing. And so that's usually the second thing out of my mouth after I say genetic testing is, this is not the type of thing that can be passed down from generation to generation. Your children or grandchildren aren't at risk for the things we're testing for. These genes aren't in every cell throughout your body. They're only in the cancer cells. They're a characteristic of the cancer cell, which is why we're going to test your biopsy.
And we know that when you look under the microscope for non-small cell lung cancer, which is the majority of lung cancer, in general, people think about it as either a squamous cell cancer or non-squamous, something else. And this lady had a non-squamous, an adenocarcinoma. What's the correlation between what you see under the microscope with these mutations?
Well, most of the mutations in lung cancer that we find are in adenocarcinoma, but they can rarely be found in squamous. I think the relationship is that squamous tumors are more likely to happen in smokers, and these mutations are much more likely to happen in non-smokers. So these things tend to run with the adenocarcinomas. But occasionally they can be found in squamous, and it's really most important to look at the mutation type when you're thinking of targeted therapies and not worry as much about the histology.
So in the metastatic situation, which is what this lady had, as opposed to adjuvant or locally advanced situation, we're talking about palliation rather than being able to cure. What are the types of mutations that are seen, and what are the therapies that are utilized?
So in lung cancer, there are more and more mutations being uncovered. It seems like every year there's one or two more. I think for someone who's newly diagnosed, what you really want to be sure not to miss are the ones that have FDA-approved treatments in the first line available. Some of the more rare mutations are patients who could benefit from a clinical trial and maybe there's not an approved drug, but the three big ones you don't want to miss in lung adenocarcinoma are EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. Those all have FDA-approved treatments that could be used right away in the frontline setting, and so those are the ones you've got to be sure to test for.
And of course, normally when we think about treatment of metastatic non-small cell, we think about chemotherapy, maybe bevacizumab, but amazingly, there's actually been a bunch of studies that actually randomly compared chemotherapy to targeted therapy for these mutations, and I guess the targeted therapies, the oral agents, the patients did better.
Right. So when the cancers have one of these lights that's stuck in the on position and they have a driver mutation dictating their behavior, they are super sensitive to these targeted treatments and they tend to be more effective than chemo.
And I guess in general, better tolerated.
You know, I think that depends on the patient. Certainly in the randomized trial, they're not tolerated more poorly than chemo, but I do think as providers, we can get into trouble promising patients that the oral drugs are going to be better tolerated because some of these oral drugs do have significant side effects. And then what I've seen as a unintended negative consequence is when it is time for the patient to switch to chemo, they're very, very hesitant because they think it's going to be this horrible thing. And honestly, with our chemo, especially with pemetrexed and some of the newer drugs, it's pretty well tolerated.
So this lady had an L858R mutation. That's one of the EGFR type mutations.
Yeah, it's one of the two common ones.
And that's, I guess EGFR is the most common type of tumor mutation that you see. What difference does it make in terms of what type of mutation you have and what are the options in terms of specifically what targeted therapy to use?
So that's something we're still learning about. EGFR mutations, there's a whole family of different subtypes, and some of them are more common, some are more rare. Most of them have a very good response to these targeted treatments. In the clinical trials that have been done, the EGFR positive patients have usually all been grouped together. Only in the last couple of years have we started to realize that for different subtypes, there may be preferences, there may not be, but for the different medications, we shouldn't just lump them together. We have to stratify and consider them separately. So there's still a fair bit of discussion. I think most of the data show that all three of the approved drugs, gefitinib, erlotinib, and afatinib, are very good for all of the EGFR mutations. There may be some subtle differences.
So what did this lady end up being treated with?
So this lady ended up being treated with afatinib, which is maybe the newest of the three drugs. And there is some data, though not consistent, that it might be a little bit better. There's certainly good practical experience that it may be a little bit more toxic too. So it's kind of got the good and the bad side of it. But I've had a fair amount of experience giving afatinib and I do like giving it. It definitely requires more care for the rash and the diarrhea and the nail changes that you can get from EGFR drugs. So you have to be vigilant and proactive.
How did she do on the afatinib?
She did great. You know, the beginning was rocky, I think, just with the diagnosis and her husband having recently passed away. But after a few months, she kind of got back up on her feet and went back to working full time and really did quite well.
And I guess one of the things that's interesting, I guess, about this targeted therapy is that most patients, I guess, respond.
Yeah. The response rates tend to run in the 60 to 70% range, but even people who don't meet an official response, usually they have a minor amount of shrinkage or stable disease. The number of patients who frankly progress through these treatments is very, very low.
So at that point, the tumor was just in her lung, and then would it shrunk down on imaging?
It had a really nice shrinkage, and of course her brain tumor had been removed, so she had very minimal disease for some time.
So I guess one of the problems with these agents is that even though most people respond, most people then at some point progress. They have disease progression. How long does it usually take before they start getting worse again?
So with the first line EGFR drug, the average is about a year until you start to see some tumor growth. So it depends on your frame of reference. For most patients, that's not a great amount of time. For a lot of oncologists, compared to chemo, it's pretty good. But this lady happened to get about 2.5 years, actually, out of hers. And she just recently started to have some growth.
And what's it been like the last 2.5 years? You mentioned she's back at work. I mean, is she basically functioning normally?
Oh, yeah. She's continued to function normally. She's traveled. You know, she's done a lot of great things. I don't think that her taking an oral pill once a day has really impacted her life all that much.
What about the choice of the chemotherapy? First of all, she got carboplatin as opposed to cisplatinum. Why did you choose carbo? And she got pemetrexed. She could have gotten, for example, a taxane.
Yeah, so I favor pemetrexed almost all the time in adenocarcinoma patients. It doesn't make you lose your hair. It's very well tolerated. And based on the Scagliotti data, we know that it has special activity in adenocarcinoma, although to be fair, that didn't compare to taxanes. But, you know, so I think over the years, a lot of oncologists have migrated to using pemetrexed in adeno. Cis versus carbo is also a style thing. In the U.S., most people will give a patient with metastatic cancer carboplatin, although in Europe, honestly, they give cisplatin much more. And personally, I have started using cisplatin more myself. I think what U.S. oncologists have been hesitant about, one, is the chair time. It takes a lot longer to treat someone with cisplatin because they have to have fluid before and after. But second, the nausea in the old days was much worse. Now we have stronger anti-nausea medicines that we can give with the cisplatin, and it's much better.
I hear that lots of patients, not just lung cancer, it seems like every cancer, are walking into the office saying, I saw this ad for a checkpoint inhibitor on TV, and I don't know whether she asked you that, but certainly it would be a question about, you start her on chemo bevacizumab. Another alternative would have been to give her a checkpoint inhibitor such as nivolumab and pembrolizumab. I don't know exactly when this occurred because our knowledge base is changing so quickly. But what about the patient like this with a target mutation, T790 negative, now you're going to something else, checkpoint inhibitor versus chemo bevacizumab?
Yeah, so they don't put this information in all those commercials on TV, but the checkpoint inhibitors are very unlikely to work in patients, lung cancer patients with a targetable mutation like EGFR or ALK. We're not quite sure all the reasons behind it. We think that tumors, in order to respond to immune therapy, need lots of different antigens, and these oncogene-addicted cancers are really much more homogeneous, and they don't have a lot of different antigens. It's certainly something to try for an EGFR patient, but not before chemo for sure. You know, usually after one or two types of chemo, you could try that.
And I know you've got a patient who got a checkpoint inhibitor, so we'll get into that with a little more detail. But just thinking about this woman's future, again, chemo bevacizumab, you know, is not usually curative. What do you see as potentially her next therapy or the therapy beyond?
Well, one important thing is to not forget to go back to EGFR inhibitors. You know, she's not taking an EGFR inhibitor now. She's having chemotherapy. Many times, patients can have a second response to an EGFR inhibitor. And we have actually seen patients change their T790M status over time. So even though when we checked her before, she was negative, in the future, she may be positive. So it's important not to assume that one biopsy done at one point in time holds true forever in these patients.
So we talked about the fact that the management in this situation has changed dramatically, looking for this T790 mutation. These patients relapse on EGFR TKIs. But you also referred to something else that happened at around the same time, and your group's been very involved with this, which is instead of actually looking at the mutation in a biopsy, to look at it in the serum and even the urine. What do we know about that?
So what happens is the cancer actually sheds DNA. We talked a little earlier about how the mutation isn't throughout the body, it's only in the tumor. That's still true, but the tumor is near blood vessels, and so debris from the cancer falls into the blood vessels, and then it can get filtered through the kidney and go into the urine just like everything else in the blood. So there are many companies and different academic centers out there developing tests that can look in the blood and potentially in the urine and look for tiny fragments of DNA that come from the tumor and actually find these mutations.
And of course, obviously, it's a lot easier to get blood drawn or give a urine specimen than actually have a biopsy. particularly in a patient like this where you'd have to biopsy the lung.
That's right.
But I've kind of heard of sort of a general paradigm about these blood or serum tests in urine is if it's positive, you can believe it, but if it's negative, not necessarily.
Right. So they're very sensitive. And if you do see the mutation in the blood, it's pretty believable. But not all cancers are shedding debris into the blood. So if your blood test is negative, it may mean that the DNA did not have the mutation, or it may mean there just was no DNA.
So, you know, when you were saying about the fact that this woman in particular seems to have problems in terms of brain mets, I was thinking, wow, it's a shame that she didn't have the T790, not only because there's a drug, but because you and others have shown that this drug, osimertinib, seems particularly effective in the central nervous system. Maybe to kind of get into that, you can talk a little bit about your 58-year-old man. It seemed like he kind of started the journey similar to her. He got erlotinib. You mentioned, you know, afatinib, erlotinib, gefitinib. He happened to get erlotinib. He actually got it for 3.5 years, but then had disease progression. And on the other hand, he had the T790 mutation. Now, was that detected with the serum or tissue?
He had both as well. And we've just been trying to get a handle on, can you get away from the tumor mutation test, the biopsy, by doing a liquid biopsy. So when he started to have multiple lung nodules grow, one of them was able to be biopsied, and we did the serum testing. They both, again, were concordant, T790M positive. So we started him on osimertinib.
And I guess, you know, you're in a research center, you're trying to learn particularly about this correlation, but what I'm hearing more from people in practice is they get the serum. If it's negative, then they start thinking about its tissue.
And I think that's a good way to approach it. And now we do have an FDA-approved serum test. So when these folks were getting their biopsies, I don't think it was approved yet. But now there's an FDA-approved serum test, which is great.
And, you know, it's interesting. We only have seen some data on urine analysis of assays fairly recently. But I don't hear too many people talking about it. And yet, to me, it looks like if it's positive, it gives you the same message.
Yes, well, the urine tests aren't as advanced as a plasma test at this point. Right now, you can, through commercial vendors, you can get next-generation sequencing panel from the plasma, which I really like. So not only to look at EGFR or maybe the one thing that you're most suspicious of, but it can look at a bunch of other genes too, and sometimes you'll find something that can be helpful. The urine tests are just one-offs at this time, but you never know.
So you mentioned that he got osimertinib. What do we know about osimertinib, both in terms of efficacy as well as side effects and tolerability?
Yeah, so osimertinib is one of the third generation EGFR drugs, they're called, and there are some others in this class as well that aren't yet FDA approved, but some of them might get there. What's really cool about this whole class of third generation drugs is not only does it hit the most common resistance mutation, the T790M, but it also does not hit the wild type EGFR, the main bugaboo that gave us the side effects from the initial drugs. So the EGFR wild type is found in the skin and the gastrointestinal tract, and that's why EGFR inhibitors are usually associated with rash and diarrhea. These third generation drugs do not hit wild type, so they have very, very low rates of rash and diarrhea, very well tolerated.
So did this man have any tolerability issues?
He's done very well. First of all, he had a great response in his tumor when he started on the osimertinib, and he's also tolerated it very well.
You know, you mentioned that he responded, and as we were saying, for first-line therapy, most people respond. But I think you see the same thing in the T790 patients.
Yeah, it's about a 70%.
Amazing.
70%. And very few patients that progress right through it. It's either stable in about 30% or responding in 70%.
So you have double good news here. It causes anti-tumor benefit, but also seems to be well tolerated. The other thing that I wasn't really aware of until recently, and again, you've done a lot of this work, is it seems to be particularly effective in the CNS, not just the brain, but even meningeal disease. Can you talk about what we know about that?
Yeah, so even though a lot of these oral inhibitors can get into the brain, which we had mentioned, a lot of times you still see failures. In fact, the first patient of mine that we talked about, she had this failure in the brain as her first site, and that's very common, unfortunately. osimertinib seems to be, at least in the realm of EGFR inhibitors, the best at getting in the brain. And it can be even, because of the data, there was a study looking at patients with leptomeningeal disease and brain mets specifically. Sometimes, I've had this with many insurance companies, you can sometimes get the drug approved even if patients don't have T790M or you don't know their status, if they're progressing in the brain on another EGFR drug because of the trials that have been done.
Yeah, I think it was important to mention the fact that, I mean, osimertinib is only used in this situation, but it's also being tested as first-line therapy.
Yeah, it is.
And it'd be great if it was at least as efficacious as the other, because theoretically you'd have less toxicity, although, again, those trials are kind of in progress. Can you explain a little bit, because it is a very uncommon complication of cancer, what meningeal involvement is, how patients progress, and what you've seen when you give patients like that who also have EGFR tumor mutations when you give them osimertinib?
So in general, it is uncommon, but in lung cancer patients that have these gene mutations and tend to live on the longer side, multiple years, it's actually very common towards the end of life. And it's a tricky problem. This is usually what gets the best of people. So the meninges are the thin lining around the brain, and they can become studded with just little polka dots of cancer. It can be very hard to see on an MRI because it's such a thin structure. It's kind of like peritoneal carcinomatosis. So it can be hard to diagnose. A lot of times the symptoms are different than a parenchymal brain met, where you might have headache and sort of space-occupying problems. With the leptomeningeal disease, you tend to get cranial nerve problems. So people might have double vision, you know, trouble moving their tongue, disconjugate gaze. Those types of things are very worrisome for leptomeningeal disease.
And what have you seen in terms of response? Have you had patients who had these cranial nerve problems and other neurologic problems who they actually got better?
Yes, especially with osimertinib, I have seen that. I mean, we used to see that with some of the earlier, you know, erlotinib, some of the earlier EGFR drugs, where on a clinical trial basis, they might get better in some ways, like their CSF might clear, but clinically they weren't really much better. It's actually been amazing, some of the clinical improvements that we've seen. There was one gentleman who came in, we had the expanded access protocol of osimertinib right before it got FDA approved, and he was in a wheelchair and having a lot of trouble talking because of his extensive leptomeningeal disease. And a couple of months after being on osimertinib, he was out walking, played a round of golf. I mean, really amazing effects.
Any predictions about how we might be using osimertinib in the future, 3 to 5 years from now? We mentioned the fact that it's being looked at up front as first-line therapy. What about in the adjuvant setting? Right now, these agents are typically not used. Is osimertinib being looked at? And do you think in the future we're going to be using targeted therapy in patients with these mutations after surgery?
Well, it makes sense. I mean, the whole thought of adjuvant treatment is you're trying to kill microscopic cells. And if you have something that the tumor is particularly susceptible to because of the biologic way it's set up, you think it would work. We've had a hard time in lung cancer proving that targeted therapy works in the adjuvant setting. But there's a big trial going on now, The Alchemist, which hopefully will shed some light on that, looking at both adjuvant treatment for EGFR patients as well as ALK in two separate studies. I think osimertinib probably is going to make its way to the frontline setting for metastatic patients. There's an ongoing trial that you mentioned comparing erlotinib to osimertinib. We don't know the results yet, but if I were a betting woman, I would probably put my money on the osimertinib. The trouble with using it in the frontline that we're going to have to learn about quickly is that we aren't as sure what happens at resistance, and we may not have as many tools in our tool belt yet for that time point, whereas, you know, we do have a great tool for erlotinib resistance that many patients can get, but not all.
Why don't we spend the rest of our time talking about your 68-year-old man? It looks like there are a number of things that we can get into with this case. I guess initially he presented in 2013. Can you talk about what happened at that point?
Yeah, so this is a guy who I had known for a while because actually I cared for his wife. She had lung cancer about 5 or 6 years before he did.
Wow.
And we treated her for stage 3 adenocarcinoma, and she was a survivor, still
wow.
is the long-term survivor. So he was down visiting his daughter in Florida for the holidays a couple years ago and just started having this cough, went to an emergency room, and was found to have a big mass in his lung. So cut his Christmas vacation short.
He was a smoker?
He was a former smoker, pretty decent number of pack years, but had quit recently, you know, in the last 20 years or so, was not a smoker, but came back to Boston and we biopsied the mass and it was a squamous cell lung cancer.
And what was the extent of the disease at that point?
So he did not have any metastatic spread, but he had a pretty big tumor that did not look like it was going to be amenable to a surgical resection.
So he was basically locally advanced, I guess, like his wife, right?
Yeah.
And you know, globally, because I was struck by the fact that you said she survived, globally, what fraction of people with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer are cured?
Well, for definitive chemo radiation alone, if there's no surgery involved, which was the case for both his wife and him, ironically, the 5-year survivals are low, looking at the studies anywhere between 7% and 20%, so.
And typically what people receive as treatment is both chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Is that what his wife got?
Yeah, his wife did get that. She got concurrent carboplatin and paclitaxel with her radiation.
And how do you find that people in general tolerate chemo radiation? How did his wife tolerate it? And I guess that's what he got too, correct?
Yeah, well, he actually got EP5050, so slightly different regimen. She was a bit more frail than he. And that's, you know, when I see stage 3 patients unresectable, I usually consider their strength because it is a tough regimen to go for 6 or 7 weeks of daily radiation, getting chemo along the way, often have some esophagitis, and so the nutritional status can go down. And, you know, his wife had lost quite a bit of weight already and actually had a brachial plexus paralysis of her arm. So she was just really weak, and that's why we chose carbopaclitaxel for her. For him, he was more robust at the time that we were doing this treatment, so we chose a little bit more aggressive regimen with the EP5050.
And what is EP5050?
So it's cisplatin and etoposide, and the 50-50 just refers to the doses of 50 milligram per meter squared.
Now, he had a squamous cell cancer. We were talking before about the difference there. But in the non-squamous, you were talking before about pemetrexed. How do you think through, you mentioned a couple of the regimens, but pemetrexed has also been used with locally advanced disease with cisplatinum. What do we know about that, and is that a regimen you ever utilize?
Yeah, so his wife was diagnosed before that was an available regimen, but nowadays if I were to see an adenocarcinoma patient who is getting radiation, I would give them cis-pem. We just recently had a phase 3 trial comparing EP5050 with cis-pem, and they give equivalent outcomes but better side effects with the cis-pem.
So kind of like the same story in metastatic, and for that matter, adjuvant. You know, people use pemetrexed not so much because it's more effective, but better tolerated. So he gets the chemo radiation. How did he do? Did he have esophagitis?
He had a little, but he actually did very well. Really was a trooper through the treatment and had a very nice tumor shrinkage. So he did very well. He had no sign of recurrent disease for about 10 months. But then even though he had had really a dramatic shrinkage, it kind of came back. And this is the classic textbook problem with squamous cell is that it can be very locally resilient. And a lot of patients die without really widely metastatic disease, but just a local tumor that keeps coming back.
And his, as you say, regrew at 10 months. Is that a typical time for recurrence?
It's actually probably a little early for a definitive chemo radiation. Even though the recurrence rates are high, they tend to happen, you know, 18, 24 months later. So his was a little early.
What were your thoughts at that point when he was having tumor progression after the chemo radiation?
Well, the timing happened to work out that when his cancer came back, it was right after the first immune therapy was approved in lung cancer. So he ended up going on nivolumab, which is a checkpoint inhibitor. It was approved at that time for squamous cell patients. So he had squamous cell and we put him on it.
I guess the one thing about that is that the approval is in patient, at least at that point, and kind of now, at least for that agent, was in people who had chemo.
Yeah.
And he had chemo, but it wasn't for metastatic disease.
Right. So we didn't follow the letter of the law. But, you know, his prior chemo had been within a year. And so what I was really worried about was that his cancer wasn't really going to respond to another round of platinum-based chemo. So the insurance company, I don't think, was savvy enough to realize the chemo he had gotten was for stage 3 disease.
But as you said, I mean, I've heard a lot of cases like this, again, maybe not typical, of people who have recurrence, you know, even 6 months after chemo radiation. And as you say, I mean, in oncology in general, I think we have this concept that if somebody had adjuvant-type therapy within a year or so, they probably, and they're having progression, they probably aren't going to benefit. So he was able to be treated with nivolumab. What happened when he got treated?
So he tolerated it pretty well, at least initially, and his tumor started to shrink. And so we were all very happy and celebrating for several months. After a while, he did start developing some of the autoimmune side effects from the immune therapy.
So what specific problems did he encounter?
So first he had a bizarre, it almost presented like a carpal tunnel syndrome. It was his hands were kind of weak and tingly, and he got outfitted with some braces that you use for carpal tunnel, and that seemed to help. But he really couldn't do that much with his hands, which was, you know, it wasn't that it was so painful, but it really impacted his daily life because he was, you know, pretty functional. And then all of a sudden he had a hard time grasping things with his hands and manipulating. So it was pretty handicapping.
And did he see a neurologist?
He saw a rheumatologist. We put him on some steroids because we had a suspicion that it was from the immune therapy, and that seemed to help somewhat.
What do you think was going on? Was this like autoimmune peripheral neuropathy or what?
You know, we weren't sure. I mean, the end of the story is we're never exactly sure what this syndrome was, and we're seeing a lot of that with the immune therapy. He ended up seeing a rheumatologist, and he saw someone who does carpal tunnel surgeries, who did some local injections for him. And it got better, but not completely better. Then the next thing that hit him in the middle of all the wrist problems was colitis. Hmm. And the colitis was also pretty bad for him. Lost about 20 pounds from diarrhea and just not eating.
What was the nature of the colitis? Was it bloody?
It was not bloody. And a lot of times with immune therapy, it's not like an infectious colitis. It doesn't tend to be bloody. It can just be copious, voluminous, and people can get really dehydrated.
So when he presented that way, did you work him up or you just started him on the steroids?
You know, we sent off stool studies to make sure we weren't missing something infectious, but we just started him on steroids at the same time.
Now, he was still on the nivolumab at that point?
He had stopped it for a period of time with the wrists, and then we had restarted it. And not that long after we restarted it, maybe a month or 6 weeks, he started getting the diarrhea. Then we stopped it again.
And what happened once you stopped it and put him on corticosteroids?
It took a long time to recover. So he had pretty bad diarrhea, but not bad enough. Sometimes with the autoimmune, they actually start giving people autoimmune treatments that are developed for Crohn's disease and things. So he didn't get to the point where he needed the infliximab treatment. But still, he was on steroids for quite some time, probably about 3 months, I think.
Are there concerns, particularly in cases like this where the patient's on corticosteroids for a while? We know that corticosteroids can be immune suppressants.
Yeah.
Is there a concern that in some way it's going to sort of counteract what the checkpoint inhibitor did?
Yeah, there's concern about that. I don't think we know for sure. There certainly are anecdotal stories of patients from the original nivolumab trials who had to stop for an autoimmune problem and then never resumed, and their cancer never came back. But, I mean, I think in practice, even if you stay on the nivolumab, you're still unlikely to be one of those 2 or 3 year survivors that we hear about from the trials.
So what was going on? You had to stop the treatment. Was the tumor still staying in remission?
So by the time we got his diarrhea under control, after a few months of steroids, he had one set of scans where things looked quiet, and so we just said, let's leave well enough alone. Just check again in a couple months, no treatment yet, because we don't want the diarrhea to start back up. But then when we checked again a couple months later, it had regrown.
What a difficult situation. You have a lethal disease. You have a therapy that was working. And what a difficult situation. What did you do?
So because of how bad, I mean, he had actually been admitted a couple of times during the diarrhea episodes, and we all decided that it wasn't worth the side effects for him of going back on an immune therapy. So we moved on to a different chemotherapy. He ended up getting some weekly nab-paclitaxel. And then, unfortunately, that didn't work. So then we were going to switch to, I believe, gemcitabine. He just recently passed away. His tumor kept coming back locally and eventually had an obstruction problem.
You know, I was going to ask you before about the chemotherapy, because usually when somebody has metastatic squamous cell, they present with metastatic squamous, not necessarily they recurred. So he was a little bit different. But in a more typical situation of metastatic squamous cell cancer, right now, how do you think through upfront treatment?
So I think a really important thing for new diagnoses of lung cancer, squamous or adeno these days, is to get PD-L1 testing, because now we can use immune therapy in the front line.
Can you explain what PD-L1 testing is and how it relates to checkpoint inhibitors?
So PD-L1 is a stain that they put on the, it's an immunohistochemistry study. So it's not looking for a genetic change like EGFR, but it's looking at the, does a tumor pick up this stain or not? And it gives you a percentage from 0 to 100. And if the percentage is above 50%, we can use immune therapy in the front line. I mean, the PD-L1 testing is a little different than the genetic testing. If you come back with an EGFR mutation, you have a very, very high chance of responding to an EGFR inhibitor. The PD-L1, it does correlate. The higher your PD-L1 is, the more likely you are to respond. But even low numbers, it doesn't absolutely rule it out. It's more of a best guess. It gives you a lead. But, you know, there's been a lot of controversy and discussion about understanding PD-L1. There's different stains that you can use. Different companies had been using different stains. So I think we're still learning about it.
So, of course, a checkpoint inhibitor, if the patient has an elevated PD-L1 level, is a great option, a lot less toxic than chemotherapy. But for the patients who aren't going to get a checkpoint inhibitor, how do you sort through? You mentioned the fact that this man received nab-paclitaxel. How do you sort through the various chemotherapeutic options that you use in metastatic squamous?
Well, I think pemetrexed is the only lung cancer drug that really isn't approved in squamous. It doesn't seem to be as efficacious. You have lots of other good choices between paclitaxel and nab-paclitaxel. You've got gemcitabine. And, of course, you can use docetaxel, and even ramucirumab, one of the VEGF inhibitors, is allowed in squamous cell, although I haven't been using it much in squamous cell. But there's lots of choices. I tend to use platinum with either gemcitabine or a taxane up front, and then whichever one I didn't use, I use that later, you know, after immune therapy as well.
You mentioned ramucirumab. Can you explain what that agent is and in what situations, if any, you use it?
Yeah, so it's kind of a cousin of bevacizumab. It's a VEGF inhibitor, and it's approved in combination with docetaxel in the second line. It's approved for both squamous and adeno patients. It improved outcomes compared to docetaxel alone. And the thing is that it didn't improve outcomes a whole heck of a lot, just slightly. And it did increase toxicity a good amount. So I think that it's something to consider in very robust patients. But now that immune therapy has come out, you know, we have really good second-line options with immune therapy. So I think ramucirumab is a little lost in the transition to immune therapy.